transient truth as they move through one or another stage of their existence. Every person I have known tricks himself into thinking that this current way of things will continue on year after year. It is so easy to speak of expectations, of what will be in a decade, perhaps, and to be convinced that the important aspects of one's life will remain as they are, or will improve as desired. This will be my life in a year. This will be my life in 5 years. This will be my life in 10 years. We all tell ourselves these hopes and dreams and expectations, and with conviction, for the goal is needed to facilitate the journey. But in the end of that span, be it 1 or 5 or 10 or 50 years hence, it is the journey and not the goal, achieved or lost, that defines who we are. The journey is the story of our life, not the achievement or failure at its end. And so the more important declaration, by far, I have come to know is, this is my life now. I am Drizzt Do'Urden, once of Mithril Hall, once the battered son of a drow matron mother, once the protege of a wondrous weapons master, once loved in marriage, once friend to a king and to other companions no less wonderful and important. Those are the rivers of my memory, flowing now to distant shores, for I reclaim my course and my heart. But not my purpose, I am surprised to learn, for the world has moved beyond that which I once knew to be true. For this realm has found a new sense of darkness and dread that mocks he who would deign to set things aright. Once, I would have brought with me light to pierce that darkness. Now I bring my blades, too long unused, and I welcome that darkness. No more. I am rid of the open wound of profound loss. I lie. Drizzt Do'Urden. Chapter 1. The Damned. The Year of Knowledge Unearthed. 1451 DR. It was a clever device she had fashioned, a thimble-like conical piece of smooth cedar with a point like a spear and an opening that allowed her to fit it onto her finger. She slipped it on and gently rotated a knot in the wood, and the mundane became magical as the finger spear diminished and took the form of a beautiful sapphire ring. The glittering adornment fit the majestic image of Dahlia Sean Fail. Her tall, lithe elf form was topped by a head shaved clean, but for a single thin clutch of raven black and cardinal red locks, woven to run down the right side of her shapely head and nestle in the hollow of her deceptively delicate neck. Her long fingers, wrapped with more than that one jeweled ring, were tipped with perfect nails, painted white and set with tiny diamonds. Her icy blue eyes could freeze a man's heart or melt it with a simple look. Dahlia appeared the artist's epitome of Thayan aristocracy, a lady great even among the greatest, a young woman who could enter a room and turn all heads in lust, in awe, or in murderous jealousy. She wore 7 diamonds in her left ear, one for each of the lovers she had murdered, and 2 more small, sparkling studs in her right ear for the lovers she had yet to kill. Like some of the men of the day, but few if any other Thayan women, Dahlia had tattooed her head with the blue dye of the woad plant. Dots blue and purple decorated the right side of her nearly hairless skull and face, a delicate and mesmerizing pattern enchanted by the master artist to impart various shapes to the viewer. As the woman gracefully turned her head to the left, one might see a gazelle in stride among the reeds of blue. When she snapped back angrily to the right, perhaps a great cat would rear up to strike. when her blue eyes flashed with lust, her target, be it man or woman, might fall helplessly into the dizzying patterns of Dahlia's woad, entrapped and mesmerized, perhaps never to emerge. She wore a crimson gown, sleeveless and backless and cut low in the front, the soft round curves of her breasts contrasting starkly with the sharp seam of rich fabric. The gown reached nearly to the floor, but was slit very high up the right side, drawing the eyes of lusting onlookers, man and woman alike, from her glittering red-painted toenails, past the delicate straps of her ruby sandals, and up the porcelain skin of her shapely leg, nearly to her hip. From there, one's eyes could not help but be drawn to the base of the V, and up to the shining tip of the singular black and red braid, the image there framed by a wide, high open collar that presented her slender neck and her perfectly shaped head like a colored glass vase holding a fresh bouquet. Dahlia Seenfail knew the power of her form. The look on Corvin Dorcray's face when he entered her private room only confirmed that. He came at her eagerly, wrapping his arms around her. He was not a tall man, nor thick with muscle, but his grip was strengthened by his affliction, and he pulled her to him roughly, raining kisses along her jaw.
"You will not be long in pleasing yourself, no doubt, but what of me?" she asked,
the innocence in her voice only adding to the sarcasm. Dorcray moved back enough to look up into her eyes and smiled widely, revealing his vampire fangs. "I thought you enjoyed my feast, milady," he said. And he went right back at her, biting her softly on the neck.
"Be easy, my lover," she whispered.
But she moved in a teasing way as she spoke to ensure that Dorcray could do no such thing. Her fingers played along his ear and swirled amidst his long, thick black hair. She had been teasing him all night long, after all, and with sunrise nearing he hadn't much time, not up in the many-windowed tower. He tried to walk her back to the bed, but she held her ground, and so he pressed in more tightly and bit down more forcefully.
"Be easy,"
she whispered with a giggle that coaxed him on all the more.
"You'll not make me one of your kind."
"Play with me through eternity," Dorcray replied, and he dared bite harder, his fangs finally puncturing Dahlia's beautiful skin. Dahlia lowered her right hand to her side and reached her thumb over the illusionary ring on her index finger, tapping the gem. She slid both of her hands onto Dorcray's chest, undoing the leather ties of his shirt and pulling the fabric wide, her fingers fluttering over his skin. He groaned, pressed in closer, and bit down harder. Dahlia's right hand felt his breast and slipped delicately to the hollow of his chest, and there she cocked back her index finger as if it were a viper readying to strike.
"Retract your fangs," she warned,
though her voice was still throaty, still a tease. He groaned, and the viper struck. Dorcray sucked in a breath he didn't need, let go of Dahlia's neck, and eased back, grimacing every inch as the pointed wooden tip invaded his flesh and prodded at his heart. He tried to back away, but Dahlia expertly paced him, keeping the pressure just right to exact excruciating, crippling pain without killing the creature outright.
"Why do you make me torment you so, lover?" she asked. "What have I done to so deserve such pleasure from you?"
She turned her hand just a bit as she spoke, and the vampire seemed to shrink before her, his legs buckling.
"Dahlia," he managed to plead.
"A 10-day has passed since I gave you your task," she replied.
Dorcray's eyes went wide with horror.
"A dread ring," he blurted. "Zastam would expand them."
"I know that, of course."
"To new areas."
Dahlia growled and twisted the tiny spike, driving Dorcray down to one knee.
"The shadow of our strong in Neverwinter Wood, south of the city of Neverwinter," the vampire grunted. They have chased the paladins from Helm's Hold and patrolled the forest unhindered.
Imagine that, Dahlia exclaimed sarcastically at yet another bit of common knowledge.
There are rumblings. The host tower, magical wards, and unleashed energy.
Wicked Dahlia cocked her shapely head despite herself and eased up her prodding finger just a bit.
I know not the full tale as of yet,
the vampire said, his words coming more easily.
It is shrouded in mystery, older than the oldest elf. In a time long ago when the host tower of the Arcane in Luskin was first built, there are...
He stopped with a grunt as Dahlia's wood-covered finger burrowed in. To the point, vampire. I haven't an eternity. She looked at him slyly. And if you offer me eternity one more time, I'll show you an abrupt end to your own.
There is magical instability there due to the fall of the host tower, Dorcray blurted. It is possible that we could create carnage on a scale sufficient.
Again the woman twisted the words from his mouth, silencing him. Luskin, Neverwinter, the Sword Coast. The significance of that region was no mystery to Dahlia. The mere mention of the area rekindled memories of her childhood, memories she clutched close to her heart as constant reminders of the wretchedness of the world. She shook the haunting images away. It was not the time, not with a dangerous vampire held at arm's length. What more? She demanded. A panicked look came over the vampire, who obviously had nothing substantial to add, and expected a sudden end to his existence at the hands of the merciless elf. But Dahlia was more intrigued than she showed. She retracted her hand so suddenly, Dorcray fell to hands and knees and closed his eyes in silent thanks. There is no time you are near me when I cannot kill you, the woman said. The next time you forget that and try to afflict me, I will utterly, happily, joyously destroy you. Dorcray looked up at her, his expression conveying that he didn't doubt her for a heartbeat. Now make love to me, and do it well, for your own sake, the elf said. It had been a fine trip to the stream for water. The pollywogs had just hatched, and the 12-year-old elf lass had found hours of enjoyment observing their play. Her mother had told her not to rush, since her father was out on the hunt that day anyway, and the water would not be needed until supper. Dahlia came over the rise and saw the smoke, heard the cries, and knew the Dark Ones had come. She should have fled. She should have turned around and run back to the stream and across it. She should have abandoned her doomed village and saved herself, hoping to rejoin her father later on. But she found herself running home, screaming for her mother. The Netherese barbarians were there, waiting. Dahlia pushed away the memories, channeling them, as she always channeled them, into her need for dominance. She slapped the vampire aside and rolled atop him, taking full control. Dorcray was a most excellent lover, which was why Dahlia had kept him alive for so long, and the woman's distraction had given him the upper hand. But only for a short while. She went at him angrily, turning their lovemaking into something violent, punching him and clawing at him, showing him the wooden finger prod at just the right moment to deny him his pleasure while she experienced her own. Then she pulled away from him and ordered him gone, and warned him that her patience neared its end and that he should not return to her, should not come into her sight until he had more to reveal about the host tower and the potential for catastrophe in the west. The vampire slunk away like a beaten dog, leaving Dahlia alone with her memories. They murdered the men. They murdered the youngest and the oldest of the females who were not of childbearing age. And for the two poor villagers with child, the barbarians were most cruel of all, cutting the children from their wombs and leaving both to die in the dirt.
And for the rest, the Netherese shared their seed violently, repeatedly. In their demented fascination with mortality, they sought the elves' wombs as if partaking of an elixir of eternal youth. Her dress was much like the one Dahlia had been wearing that same day. High collar, open neck and low cut, and none could deny that Silora Salm wore it in an enticing manner. Like her rival, her head was cleanly shaven, with not a hair on her pretty head. She was older than Dahlia by several years, and though Silora was human, her beauty had surely not dimmed. She stood on the edge of a dead forest, where the diseased remnants of once-proud trees reached to the very edge of the newest dread ring, a widening black circle of utter devastation. Nothing lived within that dark perversion, where ashes could be naught but ashes and dust could be naught but dust. Though she was dressed as if to attend a royal ball, Silora did not seem out of place there, for there was a coldness about her that complemented death quite well.
"The vampire inquired," explained her lone companion, the Marilis, a hulking young man barely into his 20s. He wore only a short kilt, mid-calf boots, and an open leather vest, showing off his extraordinary musculature, his wide shoulders exaggerated by the great sword he wore strapped diagonally across his back.
"What is the witch's fascination with the host tower of the arcane?" Silora asked, talking more to herself as she turned away from the Marilis. "It has been nearly a century since that monstrosity tumbled, and the remnants of the arcane brotherhood have shown no indication that they intend to rebuild it."
"Nor could they," the Marilis said. "The Driarmers of its bindings were far beyond them even before the spell plague. Alas for magic lost to the world."
Silora looked at him with open mockery.
"Something you heard in the library while spying on Dahlia?"
She held up her hand as her consort started to reply. The man was too dim to understand the insult.
"Why else would you be in a library?" she asked,
and she rolled her eyes in disgust when he looked at her with obvious puzzlement.
"Do not mock me, lady," the warrior warned.
Silora turned on him sharply.
"Pray, tell me why," she asked. "Will you take out your great sword and cleave me in two?"
The Marilis glared at her, but that only evoked a burst of laughter from the Thayan sorceress.
"I prefer other weapons," Silora said, teasing him,
and she let her hand come up to stroke the Marilis's powerful arm. The man started toward her, but she moved her palm before him to halt his advance.
"If you were in the fight," she explained.
"They are leaving this day," the Marilis replied.
"Then be quick to your work."
She gave him a little push backward, then waved at him to be gone. The Marilis offered a frustrated snort and spun away, stomping back through the trees and up the distant hill toward the castle gate. Silora watched him go. She knew how he was so easily getting near to the wary and dangerous Dahlia, and she wanted to hate him for that, to murder him even. But she found she couldn't blame the young man. She narrowed her eyes into hateful slits. How she wanted to be rid of Dahlia seen fail.
"Those thoughts do not serve you well, my pretty," came a familiar voice from within the dread ring.
And even if she hadn't recognized the voice, only one creature would dare enter so new a ring.
"Why do you tolerate her?"
Silora said, turning back to stare into the fluttering wall of blowing ash that marked the circumference of the necromantic place of power. She couldn't actually see Zastam through that opaque veil, but she could feel his presence, like a blast of a winter wind carrying sheets of stinging sleet.
"She is just a child," Zastam replied. "She has not yet learned the etiquette of a Feyen court."
"She has been here for 6 years," the woman protested.
Zastam's cackling laughter mocked her anger.
She controls Koza's needle, and that is no minor thing.
The breakstaff, Sylora said with disgust. A weapon, a mere weapon.
Not so mere to those who feel its bite.
It is just a weapon, absent the beauty of pure spellcasting, absent the power of the mind.
More than that, Zastam whispered.
But Sylora ignored him and continued. Swashbuckling trickery, she said, all flash and dazzle, and strikes a child should dodge.
I count her victims at 7, the lich reminded her, including 3 of considerable renown and reputation. Could I not bring them back to my side in a preferable form?
The manner in which he so casually referred to his reanimation of the dead sent a freezing shiver along Sylora's already cold spine.
I would fear that the Lady Dahlia might be thinning my ranks too quickly.
Count it not as her skill, Sylora warned. She coaxed them, every one, into vulnerable positions. Her youth and beauty fooled them. But now I know, now we all know.
Even Lady Katamine, said Zastam, and Sylora winced.
Katamine had been her peer, if never really her friend, and they had shared many adventures, including clearing the peasants from the land for the very dread ring she stood before. Clearing the peasants' souls, at least, for their rotting flesh had fed the ring. During that pleasurable time 3 years before, Katamine had spoken often of Lady Dahlia, and of how she had taken the young elf under her wing to properly instruct her in the arts carnal and martial. Had Katamine underestimated Dahlia? Had she been blinded by her arrogance to the dangers of the heartless elf? Katamine had become the middle diamond on Dahlia's left ear, the 4th of 7, Sylora knew, for Sylora had caught on to the elf's little symbolism. And Dahlia wore 2 studs on her right ear. Dorcray was one of her lovers, of course, and Sylora glanced toward the distant castle, along the path the Merilus had taken.
You will not have to suffer her here for some months. Years, more likely,
Zastam remarked as if reading her mind.
She is off to Luskin and the Sword Coast.
May the pirates cut her to pieces.
Dahlia serves me well, the disembodied voice of Zastam warned.
You speak so to keep me from destroying her.
You serve me well, the lich replied. I have told Dahlia as much.
Outraged, Sylora spun away and departed. How dare Zastam elevate the wayward waif to her level with such an insinuation? An important night, she knew, and so she had to look the part. It wasn't vanity that drew Dahlia to the mirror, but technique. Her art was a matter of perfection, and anything less would be a death sentence. Her black leather boots rose up above her knees, touching her matching black leather skirt on the outside of her left thigh. Nowhere else did leather meet leather, though, for the skirt was cut at a sharp angle, climbing up well above the midpoint on the thigh of her other shapely leg. Her belt, a red cord, carried leather pouches on each hip, both black with red stitching. She wore a puffed-sleeve white blouse of the finest silk, cinched with diamond cuffs to allow her free movement. A small black leather vest provided some padding, but her real armor came from a magic ring, an enchanted cloak, and small magic bracers hidden under the cuffs of her blouse. As with all of her outfits, Dahlia left the top of the low-cut vest unbuttoned and the stiff collar turned up to frame her delicate head. It would not do to be along the road under the sun with no hair to protect her pate, though, so she wore a wide-brimmed black leather hat, pinned up on the right, revealing her black and red braid, banded in red silk and stylishly plumed with a red feather. When she bent her right leg and turned it out just so, striking an alluring pose, what man could resist her? But what she saw in the mirror did not quite match the reality of her beauty. They caught her easily and threw her down, but didn't pile one after another atop her as they had with the others.
Dahlia caught the gaze of one burly barbarian, the Shadowvar of huge size and strength who had led the raid. While most of the raiders appeared as dusky-skinned humans, the leader was obviously a convert, a horned half-demon, a tiefling. The young and delicate captive, barely a woman, was his, he decreed. They stripped her down and held her for the sacrifice, and for the first time, Dahlia truly understood her foolishness in running back to the village, understood what she, and not just what her people, had to lose. She heard her mother screaming for her, and from the corner of her eyes saw the woman running at her, only to be tackled and sat upon. Then he stood over her, the huge tiefling, leering at her.
"Loosen and ease, girl, and your mother will live," he promised.
He had her. She managed to turn her head to look at her mother as he lay down atop her, and managed to bite back her screams as he tore into her, though she felt as if she was ripping in half. The act itself was over quickly, but her humiliation had only just begun. Two barbarians grabbed her by the ankles and lifted her up into the air, upside down.
"You will keep the seed of Herzgoalegni,"
they mocked as they pawed and slapped at her. Eventually they lowered her so that her head twisted painfully on the ground. She turned it enough to keep an inverted, distorted view of her mother. Enough to see the tiefling, Herzgoalegni, cross into her field of vision. He looked back at her and smiled. Could she ever forget that smile? Then, he so very casually stomped on the back of her mother's neck. Fine elf bones shattering under the blow. Dahlia took a deep breath and closed her eyes, fighting to hold her balance. But only briefly did she swoon, for she was not that child of a decade before. That young elf girl was dead, killed by Dahlia, murdered internally and replaced by the exquisite, deadly creature she saw in the mirror. Her hand went across her hard abdomen, and she recalled, just briefly, when she had been with child, with his child, with the smiling one's child. With another deep breath, she adjusted her hat, then swung away from the mirror to grab up Koza's needle. The slender metal staff stood fully 8 feet, and though it appeared glassy smooth from even a short distance, its grip was solid and sure. Its four joints were all but invisible, but Dahlia knew them as well as she knew her own wrist or elbow. With a flick of a hand, she cracked the staff at its midpoint, letting it swing down to fold onto itself into a comfortable 4-foot walking stick. She noted the slight discharge of energy as it swung, feeding her, and the muscles in her forearm twitched under the soft folds of her sleeve. She took a last glance around her bedchamber. Dorcray had taken her larger packs to the wagon already, but she let her eyes linger a few heartbeats, wanting to ensure that she had forgotten nothing. When she left, she didn't look back, though she expected that several years, perhaps many years, would pass before she again looked upon that place, which had been her home for more than half a decade. The roots tasted bitter. She couldn't help but gag as she stuffed one after another into her mouth. But the Netherese would return, the elders assured her. They knew where she was and knew she carried the child of their leader. One old elf woman had tried to talk her into killing herself to be done with it. But that girl who had foolishly run back to her village instead of away was already dead. She felt the pangs in her abdomen soon after, the terrible convulsions, the tearing agony of childbirth through a body too young to accept it. But Dahlia didn't make a sound, other than her heavy breathing as she worked her muscles and pushed with all her strength to get the beast child out of her. Covered in sweat, exhausted, she at last felt the rush of relief and heard the first cries of her baby, of Herzgoalegni's son.
The midwife placed the babe upon her chest, and a mixture of revulsion and unexpected warmth tore at the woman, as surely as the Shadowvar had torn at her loins, as surely as his son had ripped her in birth. She didn't know what to think, and took a tiny measure of comfort in hearing the women discussing their success, for she had beaten the return of the father and his brutes by several 10 days. Dahlia rested back her head and closed her eyes. She couldn't let them return. She couldn't let them determine her life's path.
"You are not gone yet?"
Sylora's psalm surprised Dahlia almost as soon as she had exited her room.
"I would have thought you halfway to the Sword Coast by now."
"Seeking to claim what fineries I've left behind, Sylora?"
Dahlia replied. She paused to strike a pensive pose for just a moment before adding,
"Take the mirror, and let it serve you well."
Sylora laughed at her.
"It will prefer my reflection, I am sure."
"Perhaps true, though I doubt many would agree. But no matter, human, for soon enough you will be old, gray, and haggard, while I am still young and fresh."
Sylora's eyes flashed dangerously, and Dahlia clutched Kozah's needle a bit more tightly, though she knew the wizard wouldn't risk the wrath of Zastam.
"Peasant," Sylora replied. "There are ways around that."
"Ah, yes, the way of Zastam,"
Dahlia mumbled. And she moved suddenly right up to Sylora, face to face, so that the woman could feel her breath hot on her face.
"When you entwine with the Merilus and inhale deeply of him, does it feel as if I am in the room beside you?"
she whispered. Sylora sucked in her breath hard and fell back just a bit, moving as if to slap Dahlia. But the young elf was quicker and had anticipated the reaction.
"And you will be pallid and unbreathing,"
she said as she cupped her free hand and grabbed Sylora's crotch.
"Cold and dry, while I remain warm and—"
Sylora wailed, and a laughing Dahlia spun away and skipped down the hall. The wizard growled at her in rage, but Dahlia spun back on her, all merriment flown.
"Strike fast and true, witch,"
she warned as she put Koza's needle up in front of her,
"for you get but one spell before I send you to a realm so dark even Zastam couldn't drag you back from it."
Sylora's hands trembled before her in nearly uncontrollable rage. She didn't speak, of course, but Dahlia surely heard every word.
"This child, this impertinent elf girl."
Her small breast heaving with gasps as she tried to regain her composure, Sylora only gradually calmed and let her hands fall to her sides. Dahlia laughed at her.
"I didn't think so,"
she said, then skipped down the hall. As she neared the keep's exit, two corridors presented themselves. To the left lay the courtyard, where Dorcray waited with the wagons, and to the right, the garden and her other lover. She had picked the spot well, and knew it. As soon as she came to the edge of the cliff, overlooking the encampment of Herzgo Alegni's Shadowvar barbarians. They couldn't get to her without running for nearly a mile to the south, and could reach up the 100-foot cliff with neither weapon nor spell.
"Herzgo Alegni!"
she cried. She presented the baby in the air before her. Her voice boomed off the stones, echoing through the ravine and reaching beyond to the encampment.
"Herzgo Alegni,"
she shouted again.
"This is your son."
And she kept shouting that over and over as the camp began to stir. Dahlia noted a couple of Shadowvar running out to the south, but they were of no concern to her. She shouted again and again. A gathering approached, far below, staring up at her, and she could only imagine their surprise that the foolish girl would come to them.
"Herzgo Alegni, this is your son,"
she screamed, presenting the child higher. They heard her, though they were 100 feet down and more than that away.
She scoured the crowd for a tiefling's form as she yelled again to the father of her baby. She wanted him to hear her. She wanted him to see. She couldn't quite read the look on the Marilis's square-jawed face as she came out into the garden. The night was dark, with few stars finding their way out from behind the heavy clouds that had settled in that evening. Several torches burned in the stiff wind, bathing the area in wildly dancing shadows.
"I didn't know if you would come," the man said. "I feared
that I would leave without a proper farewell."
The man started to answer, found no words, and simply shrugged.
"You would make love one last time?"
Dahlia asked.
"I would go with you to Luskin if you would have me."
"But since you cannot..."
He started toward her, arms outstretched, begging a hug. But Dahlia stepped back and to the side, easily keeping her distance.
"Please, my love," he said. "One moment to remember until again we meet."
"One last barb I might stab into the side of Sylora Somm?"
Dahlia asked. And the Marilis's face screwed up with puzzlement for just a moment, until the notion fully registered, replacing curiosity with a stare of disbelief. Dahlia laughed at him.
"Oh, I will stab her this night," she promised. "But you'll not stab me."
She brought her right arm forward in a sweeping motion, then flicked her wrist, unfurling her staff to its full length. The Marilis stumbled backward, eyes wide with shock.
"Come, lover,"
Dahlia teased, bringing the staff horizontally in front of her chest. With a slight move, unseen by her opponent, she cracked two joints, leaving a 4-foot center section in her hands, with twin 2-foot-long sections dropping to the ends of short chains at either side. Again, barely moving, Dahlia set those two side sticks spinning, both forward at first, then one forward and one backward. She began rolling the center bar in the air in front of her, dipping its ends alternately, heightening the spins of the respective sides.
"It need not be..."
"Oh, but it does,"
the woman assured him.
"But our love..."
"Our lust,"
she corrected him.
"I am already bored, and I'll be gone from here for years." "Come then, coward. You profess to be a grand warrior. Surely you're not afraid of a tiny creature like Dahlia."
She worked the tri-staff more furiously then, rotating the central bar in front of her, and all the while keeping the two side sticks spinning. The Marilis put his hands on his hips and stared at her hard. Dahlia grabbed the center of the long bar in one hand and broke the rotation. As the side sticks swung back to slap against the central bar, they created lightning-like bolts that Dahlia expertly directed at her opponent. The Marilis was lifted backward by the stinging bolts once, then again. Neither did any real damage, but Dahlia's laughter seemed to sting him quite profoundly. He drew his greatsword and hoisted it in both hands, taking a deep breath and setting his feet widely, just as Dahlia charged. She leaped in, slapping Koza's needle's center bar forward and back while the side sticks extended and rotated yet again. She dropped her left foot back suddenly, pulled in her left hand, extended her right, and turned so that the spinning side stick whipped at Thamarilis's head. No novice to battle, the fine warrior blocked it with his sword, then brought the blade back the other way in time to pick off the other spinning extension as Dahlia reversed her pose and thrust. But she rolled the leading edge back and over high, reversing her grip on the center bar as the weapon turned under. She stabbed straight ahead with the leading butt of the center bar, jabbing the Marilis in the chest. Again he staggered backward.
"Pathetic,"
she teased, backing a step to allow him to regain his battle posture. The warrior came on with sudden fury, slashing his claymore in great swings that hummed powerfully through the air. And he hit nothing but air. Dahlia leaped sidelong, a full somersault that set her again to her feet, with her back to the Marilis.
When the warrior pursued, thrusting his weapon at her, she whirled around and slapped his sword with a left side stick, then turned the blade with the angled center bar, and struck it again with the spinning, trailing right side stick, and all three sent jolts of electricity into the sword and into the Marillus. The man fell back, clamping his jaw against the shocking sensation. Dahlia put the staff into a dazzling spin before her again, the side sticks moving too quickly to follow. She feigned a charge but fell back instead, extending her arms fully to leave the center bar horizontal in front of her. She came forward, retracting her arms so that the bar slammed her own chest, and as it did, it broke in half. The Marillus could hardly follow the movements then as Dahlia put her two smaller weapons, each a pair of 2-foot-long metal poles bound end to end by a foot-long length of chain, into a wild dance. She rolled the flails sidelong at her sides, brought one or another, or both or neither, under and around her shoulder, or one around her back to be taken up by the other hand, while the other moved across in front to similarly and simultaneously hand off. And never with a break, never slowing, she began smacking the twirling sticks together with every pass, each strike crackled with the power of lightning. Above them the clouds thickened, and thunder began to rumble, as if the sky itself answered the hail of Koza's needle. Finally, her fury unabated, Dahlia reached out at the Marillus with a wide swing. She missed badly. She missed on purpose. The Marillus came in right behind the strike with a burst and a stab. Dahlia never stopped her turn and continued right around, stepping back as she went to stay out of reach of a deadly blade. She came around with a double parry, her weapon smacking the greatsword one after another. Neither, though, released a charge into the sword, something the Marillus didn't register. The effective double block had him slowed anyway, retracting the blade. But as Dahlia broke her momentum and reversed the swing of her left hand, he came right back in. Her parries came simultaneously, one metal rod smacking the greatsword on either side, the right lower down the blade than the left. And Dahlia released the building charge of Koza's needle. The powerful jolt weakened the Marillus's grip, even as the woman drove through the swings, and the greatsword was lost to him, spinning end over end and falling away. He reached for it, but Dahlia and her spinning weapon blocked his way, smacking at him in rapid succession. She hit one arm, then the other, again and again, and that was only when he managed to block them. When he didn't, the stick cracked him about the chest and midsection, and once in the face, fattening his lips. She quickly got ahead of his blocks, the weapons coming at him from any and every angle, battering him, cutting him, raising welt after welt. One strike hit his left forearm so forcefully, they both heard the crack of bone before he even knew he'd been hit. Stunned, off balance, and nearing the end of his strength, the warrior desperately punched out at Dahlia. She dropped, turned, and swung her right arm up, looping her weapon under and around his extended shoulder. She continued her turn, throwing the back of her hip into his, bending him over her, and with a sudden yank on the entangling weapon, she flipped the Marillus right over her shoulder. He fell flat on his back, his breath blasted from his lungs, his eyes and thoughts unfocused. Dahlia didn't slow, spinning circles, finally squaring up to the fallen man as she brought her hands clapping together in front of her, rejoining the central 4-foot length of Koza's needle. She waved the brake staff up one way, then reversed, expertly aligning the side sticks and calling upon the weapon to rejoin. The instant she was holding a singular 8-foot staff again, she drove one end to the ground and pole-vaulted off it high into the air, turning the weapon as she went and screaming, "Ye Koza!" to the dark clouds above. She landed right beside the Marillus, driving the brake staff's forward tip down like a spear into the man's chest. Fingers of lightning crackled out from the impact, and the weapon slid through the man, clipping his backbone and pressing down into the ground. Dahlia screamed out to the ancient, long-forgotten god of lightning again as she stood victorious, one hand holding the impaled weapon at midpoint, the other arm straight out to the other side, her head thrown back so she was looking up to the sky. A blast of lightning coupled with a tremendous thunderstroke hit the upper tip of the staff and channeled down. Some of its burning force entered Dahlia, bathing her in crawling lines of blue-white energy, but most of it jolted into the Marillus with devastating effect.
his arms and legs extended out wide, to their limits and beyond, kneecaps and elbows popping in protest. His eyes bulged as if they would fly from their sockets, and his hair, all of his hair, stood out straight, dancing wildly. A great hole was blown right through the man along the length of the metal staff that impaled him. And Dahlia held on, basking in the power as it flowed through her lithe form. She looked down at the gathered barbarians. Finally, she spotted Herz Goalegni among them, moving forward through their ranks.
"Herz Goalegni, this is your son," she cried.
She threw the baby from the cliff. Chapter 2. An Old Dwarf's Last Road.
"He was just a boy, many years ago," the woman protested.
She rubbed her elderly father's shoulders, and the man was clearly uncomfortable with the obvious contradictions between his tale and the reality before them. Driz Doerden held up his dark hands to reassure the two, to show the older man that he didn't disbelieve him.
"It was here,"
the man, Lathan Obradok, said.
"As wondrous a wood as I've e'er seen or heard tell of, full of springtime and warmth and singing and bells ringing. We all seen it, me and Sprague and Anata Dearber, and what was that captain's name now?"
"Ashelia," Drizzt answered.
"Aye," the old man said, "Ashelia Larson. Who knew the lake better than any? Great captain, that lady, just out fishing, you know. And we come across the lake."
He pointed back at the dark waters of Loch Dinashir, tracing a line from a distance out to the rotted old remnants of what had once been a wharf, the ruins of an old shack just up the shore from it.
"We were bringing that ranger, Roundy. He paid Ashelia to get him across the lake, I guess. You should be speaking with him."
"I did," Drizzt replied, trying to keep the exasperation out of his voice, for he had told Lathan that bit of information a dozen times at least that day, and twice that number the day before, and even before that. The previous year, Drizzt had met with the ranger, commonly known as Roundabout or Roundy, to the south of Icewind Dale, at the urging of Jarlaxle. Roundabout's description of the wood was exactly the same as Lathan's, a magical place inhabited by a beautiful witch with auburn hair and a halfling caretaker who lived in a hillside cave home by a small pond. According to Roundabout, though, only the wizard Anata Dearber had actually seen the halfling, and only Roundabout himself and a man named Spraken had seen the woman, and they had come away with very different impressions. To the ranger, she had seemed as a goddess dancing on a ladder of stars, but Spraken, according to Roundabout and confirmed by Lathan, had never truly recovered from the horror of that encounter. Drizzt sighed as he looked around at the sparse trees and stony ground of the sheltered nook at the end of a small cove, cleverly hidden by rocky outcroppings. Up above on the hillside stood scattered small pine trees, typical of Icewind Dale.
"Perhaps it was north of here," Drizzt offered. "There are many sheltered vales along the high ground at the northeastern stretches of Loch Dinashir."
The old man shook his head with every word. He pointed to the cabin.
"Right behind the lodge," he insisted. "No other lodge near here. That's the place. This is the place. The forest was here."
"But there is no forest," said Drizzt, "and no sign that any forest ever was here beyond these few trees."
"Tell you that, too," said Lathan.
"They came back after their encounter," his daughter Tallulah said. "They looked for it. Of course they did. And so did many others. Roundy'd been here many the time before that day, and came back many the time after. And never did he see the same forest again, or the witch or halfling."
Drizzt put his hand on his hip, his expression doubtful as he continued his scan, seeking something, anything he could bring back to Brunner, who, along with Puent, was visiting with some clan dwarves in the tunnels under the lone mountain of Kelvin's Cairn,
the complex that had housed Clan Battlehammer in the decades before Brunner had reclaimed Mithril Hall. Mithril Hall. 4 decades had passed since they'd left that wondrous dwarven kingdom, since Brunner had abdicated his throne in a most extreme and irreversible manner. How many adventures the three of them had shared, along with Nanfoodle the gnome and Jessa the orc. Drizzt couldn't help but smile as he considered those last two, gone from the band for more than 20 years now. And once more he'd found himself in Icewind Dale, the land of Drizzt's first real home, the land of the Companions of the Hall, the land of Cadi Bree and Regis and Wulfgar, of a displaced dwarf king and a wayward dark elf searching, forever searching, it seemed, to find a place he could rightly call his home. What a troop they had been! What adventures they had known! Drizzt and Brunner had put those three lost friends far behind them, of course, and had long ago given up any notion of finding the wayward spirits of Cadi Bree and Regis, or of rejoining Wulfgar. For a human's lifetime had passed, more than 2/3 of a century, and none of the three had been young on those fateful days so long ago. With Pwynt, Nanfoodle, and Jessa, they had searched the hilly crags east of Luskan and the foothills of the spine of the world for Gontalgrim, the elusive ancient homeland of the Delzoon dwarves. 1,000 maps had led them down 1,000 trails, through 100 deep caves, their thoughts only of Gontalgrim, or, on those occasions when Brunner and Drizzt quietly reminisced about Brunner's adopted children and their halfling friend, it was just to share their memories, so dear. An unexpected meeting with Jarlaxle and Luskan a few years previous had rekindled great hopes and great pains. Immediately after the loss of Cadi Bree and Regis, both Drizzt and Brunner had enlisted the worldly Jarlaxle to find them at any cost. The passage of 7 decades and more hadn't deterred the clever dark elf, apparently. Or perhaps it had just been dumb luck. But Jarlaxle had stumbled upon a legend that was growing in the northwestern corner of Faerûn. The legend of a magical forest inhabited by a beautiful witch, who apparently quite strikingly resembled the human daughter of King Brunner Battlehammer. The hunt had led Drizzt, Brunner, and Pwynt to round about the ranger in the small mountain village of Orkney, and he had directed them to Loch Dinashir, one of the three lakes about which were scattered the communities that gave Ten Towns its name. Drizzt looked at Lathan, whose story verified what the old ranger in Orkney had said. But where was the forest? Icewind Dale had changed little in the last century. Ten Towns had not grown. In fact, it seemed to Drizzt that there were less people in each of the towns than had been there when he'd called the place home. "Are ye even listening to me, then?" Tallulah scolded, her tone telling the daydreaming Drizzt that she had asked that question several times already. "Just thinking," he apologized. "So they and others searched for the forest, but nothing was ever found? Not a trace nor a hint?" Tallulah shrugged. "Rumors," she said. "And when I was a young girl, one boat came in with a crew all a-twitter. Do ye remember that, da?" "Barley Farhook's boat," Lathan said, nodding. "Aye, and Spragan wanted to put right out, he did, after all them years where folks snickered at our own tale. Aye, and we did go out, a few boats, but there was nothing to be found here, and they laughed at us again." "Where are your crewmates now?" Drizzt asked. "Bah, all dead," Lathan replied. "At a deerber taken in the spell plague, a Shelia's boat taken by the lake, with Spragan aboard her, too. All gone many years ago." Drizzt scanned the ruined cottage and the vale behind it, trying to figure out if there was anything left to do. He hadn't expected to find anything, of course. The world was full of wild tales of the most unusual sort, especially in the 66 years since the spell plague had descended upon Faerûn, since the death of Mistra and the great turmoil and tribulations that had shaken the foundation of civilization itself. Then again, the world was full of actual surprises as well. "You got enough,"
Tallulah asked, glancing back across the lake.
We've a long ride home, and you promised we'd be back in Cair Dinnaval tomorrow.
Drizzt hesitated a bit, helplessly scanning the horizon. Then he nodded. Help your father back into the wagon, he told her. We'll be away soon. The drow trotted off to the cottage and poked about it for a bit, then moved up into the scraggly wood, hardly a forest, crunching through the dried pine needles of seasons past. He looked for clues, any clue. The hint of a door on a hillside, a patch of ground that once might have been a pond, the hint of music in the windy air. From the side of one hillock, he looked back to see Tallulah in the open wagon, her father beside her. She waved to Drizzt, ready to depart. He moved about a bit more, hoping against all reason that he would find something, anything, to give him hope that this place, Irula Dune, Roundy had called it, had once been the forest as described to him, that the caretaker had been Regis and the marvelous witch, Catti Bree. He thought of his return to Kelvin's cairn and dreaded telling Brunner that their journey to Icewind Dale had been for naught. Where might they go now? Did old Brunner have any more roads left in him?
Come along, then,
Tallulah called from the wagon, and reluctantly the drow started down, his keen eyes still scanning the ground and trees for some sign, any sign. Drizzt's eyes were keen, but not sharp enough to see all. In his passing, he brushed by some trees and old branches and dislodged something that fell behind him. He didn't notice, and went on his way to the wagon. The trio started off on the long road that would take them around the lake and back to Cair Dinnaval. As the sun dipped lower over the lake, the light flashed white on bone. A fish bone, a piece of scrimshaw carved into the likeness of a woman holding a magical bow, the same bow Drizzt Doerden carried on his back. The air was unseasonably chilly, and storm clouds had gathered off in the northwest on the morning Drizzt walked back out of Cair Dinnaval, a reminder that the season was soon to turn. He looked to the distant peak of Kelvin's cairn and thought that perhaps he should spend another day in town and let the storm pass. Drizzt laughed at himself, at his cowardice, and not for anything to do with the weather. He didn't want to tell Brunner that he'd found not a sign, not a tease. He knew he shouldn't tarry, of course. Autumn was falling, and in a matter of 10 days, the first snows would come sweeping down upon Icewind Dale, sealing the one pass through the mountains to the south. On the rocky cliff between the town's welcoming inn and the old castle of the Deneve family, the drow lifted his unicorn pendant to his lips and blew into the horn. He spotted Andahar, a tiny flash of white before him, approaching fast. The steed seemed no bigger than his closed hand at first, but each stride along the rift between dimensions doubled its size, and in moments, the powerful equine beast trotted to a stop in front of Drizzt. Andahar pawed the ground and shook his thick neck, white mane flying wildly. Drizzt heard the excited chatter of the guards at the Cair's gate, but he didn't even look back to acknowledge them, nor was he surprised by their reaction. Who would not be awe-stricken at the first glimpse of Andahar, tacked and with barding that glittered in the daylight with rows of bells and jewels? Drizzt grabbed the steed's mane and agilely leaped into the saddle. Then he did salute the gawking folk at the gate before turning the magnificent unicorn to the north and thundering off toward Kelvin's cairn. What a wonderful gift Andahar had been, the drow thought, and certainly not for the first time. The ruling council of Silvery Moon had commissioned the mount for Drizzt, in gratitude for his work, both with the blade and diplomacy, in the Third Orc War. The wind whistled past his ears as Andahar galloped across the miles. The drow wasn't cold, though, not with the warmth generated by the unicorn's great muscles. His hair and cloak flew wide behind them. He called forth the bells to sing with the ride, and they answered to his will. Trusting in Andahar, Drizzt let his thoughts slip back to pleasant memories of his old friends. He was disappointed, of course, in not finding any sign of the mysterious witch of the wood, or the curious halfling caretaker, disappointed at the reaffirmation of that which he already knew to be true. He still had his memories, though, and on occasions like this, alone and on the trail, he looked for them and found them, and couldn't help but smile as he thought of that previous life he had known. That previous life he knew he should forget. That previous life he could not forget.